This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The crushing heat in this year of 2016 is not the first to strike Pakistan and India. Just last year, thousands died, and Pakistan suffered a kind of heat paralysis. What happened then and now? Our guest is the Dean of the Pardee School of Global Studies at Boston University. He's a professor of international relations concerning Earth and the environment. And Dr. Adil Najam was a vice chancellor at Lahore University of Management Sciences in Pakistan. Adil, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock. Let's talk about last year's heat emergency. 1,000 people died in the heat of Karachi in 2015. Please describe that heat event for us.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for this conversation. Last year was a particularly bad year in terms of the impact of the heat. Now, Pakistan or South Asia is not a part of the world that is unfamiliar to heat, even to intense heat. This is the place where the highest recorded ever temperatures are routinely recorded. But one of the things that happened last year was that the intensity was more. The time period over which the heat wave persisted was more. This was true for South Asia in general, India and Pakistan in particular, and Karachi in Pakistan in particular. In Pakistan and Karachi's case, the perfect storm happened because this also came in the midst of the Muslim month of Ramadan, which is a month of fasting. And what that meant was that there were people who were fasting for religious reasons, who were trying to sort of push themselves harder. More than that, the infrastructure of support that is already missing in a poor country, especially for the poorest people, became even weaker. So all of these things combined to create this sort of massive wave and this number of, a very large number of people who died because of it. And it literally shook not just the large city of Karachi, but the country.
And just so we know, how many people live in Karachi?
Karachi is one of the largest cities in the world. You have certainly upwards of 10 million people living in this city. And I say that without precision because Pakistan has not had a census for a very long time. And the number of people who are kind of undocumented is even larger. So my own guess is we are talking about closer to 15 rather than 10 billion people.
And is electricity for fans or air conditioning reliable in Karachi?
No, it is not. It is not reliable anywhere in Pakistan. But here is the thing. Anyone who can afford a air conditioner, which is very, very few people, and now I'm talking in single-digit percentages, can probably afford to run it because they'll also afford a generator of some sort. Anyone who can afford a fan, and that is not something that everyone would have, probably is still has some infrastructure to be able to survive and deal with this heat. The real issue is, and this is really the nub of climate change, that most people in a city like Karachi, but most people in the world, do not have the paraphernalia of dealing with these things that you and I might take for granted, right? We would take it for granted that, yes, you are poor, but that means you'll probably have a fan. Well, that's just not true for most people, not only in Karachi, but actually in the world.
And you have said half the deaths were preventable. What should national and state governments do to prepare for more heat events?
Well, I think all of the deaths are preventable. First of all, I am convinced that at least part of this, and we cannot say which part, is related to climate change. And even if this is not, we're going to see more and more of that. And that means there's blood on your hands and mine. Right? So first, let's just start with that, that this is not just nature happening on its own. This is you and I and those of us particularly who are more affluent. Having outsourced our misery by our lack of action on climate change. But that may be a more deeper conversation. On an immediate level, I think that, and many believe that these are preventable because this is not a country that is not used to heat. B, heat is something that you can deal with. It is a question of hydration. It's a question of not air conditioning as much as just getting water to people, making it easier for people to get a regular intake of water during the day. You know, things that we kind of take for granted and never talk about, a shade. Right now you're talking about very poor people mostly working outside in intense heat at a time when, because as I said, because of Ramzan, the infrastructure of dealing with that heat is low. Simply not having trees in a city, right? It's a very simple thing. But if you have ever walked anywhere in the sun, whether for pleasure or out of necessity, after a little while, if there is some place of shade where you can just sit and rest for a while, it makes a huge difference. And all of these things sound very, very small, but they are not, especially when they add up in a multi-million person metropolis. And that's why these are entirely preventable things. The tragedy is that we as a planet, and even Pakistan as a country, has the ability to deal with these things, and it is the negligence of our generation that these things keep happening. This time it was Karachi, but you also saw this in India. You see this with droughts in Africa and in Asia all the time. So there is a pattern to this. Here is my bottom line. People do not die because of heat. People die because of the inability to deal with that heat. And that means they die because of poverty, they die because of bad decisions, they die because of a lack of development.
That's so true. Well, it isn't just the heat. The 2010 floods in Pakistan were devastating. It must take years for the country to recover from such weather extremes, and I assume some farmers and families never do.
Some don't, but here is the sad thing about the flood. The 2010 floods, and we are now in 2016, never ended. What do I mean by that? We are now in the sixth consecutive year of floods, and now it doesn't even make the news. So there were multiple hundreds of people who died earlier this year in April in this year's flood. So every year since 2010, now the floods have kind of become this repetitive thing, and at least part of that is the melting of the glaciers up in the Himalayas, again, possibly with impact from climate change. And if you think about it, you know, I'm guessing your listeners are thinking, well, I didn't hear about them. That's because most people didn't hear about them. Even in Pakistani newspapers, it no longer makes news if 100 people die because of floods. And you kind of internalize this as if this is a new normal. Well, dying people should never be a normal. And it's not just the floods. We are also now in the fourth year of a drought in another part of Pakistan, in Thar, where children keep dying literally every day. And that also doesn't make news. And so this, to me, is the reality of a world with climate change. It is not simply the reality that there is more death and destruction and disaster. It is also the reality that you become immune to being moved by that death and destruction. It becomes a new normal, and we keep moving on as if, okay, this is how it was supposed to be. So if you look around the world at these climate-induced disasters, and you look at all of them together, you suddenly see, well, there's something happening. But we are also like that frog in boiling water, getting used to this as if, well, this is how it is. And that is a tragedy.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest Adil Najam. We're talking about Pakistan in the new age of global heat. Let's talk about Pakistan's energy sources. I'm just learning about that ice loss in the northern mountains of Pakistan, which you just mentioned. I presume that the many hydroelectric dams have enough water to run?
The politics of energy in Pakistan is pretty intense, as it is in many, many developing countries. Pakistan, back in the 60s, was at the forefront of building large hydroelectric dams. They were the motors of Pakistan's economic growth at that time. There were some mistakes also made. But since then, this kind of this political logjam on building new hydroelectric power, largely because of differences between different parts of Pakistan and the feeling that these benefit one part and not another. It's not an entirely unreasonable feeling, but that sort of kind of brought to a standstill the ability of the country to use hydroelectric to its potential. And also, I think there was a certain fascination with large dams as opposed to small and medium and even micro dams that could have benefited. So at this point, Pakistan is sort of under, has less energy and has a major energy crisis. And unfortunately, instead of looking at renewable sources, a lot of the emphasis and passion is being spent towards trying to build coal. And that, in my view, is not the best of solutions, but it is the direction that the country seems to be heading towards.
Yes, I was surprised to find out Pakistan has undeveloped coal reserves.
Pakistan does have undeveloped coal reserves. It is not the best quality coal in terms of cost and environmental features, but people like myself have also been arguing that even if you leave aside the environmental aspect, and in many cases, I can argue legitimately that countries like Pakistan, which use very little energy to begin with, which have very low carbon footprints of their own, their responsibility is different from large countries like the US or Europe that, or China or India, that have very large carbon footprints. But even if for a moment you leave aside the carbon question, coal to me is a dying technology. It is pretty clear that the writing on the wall is that we are moving away from the age of coal. So if you think about it, the largest coal company in the US recently went bankrupt. Weeks after that, the largest coal supplier in the world, a Chinese company, announced that they're going to move to begin trying to be a supplier of renewable energy. So this is not the best time to move into coal, just from an economic and investment point of view. And I've been sort of arguing, you know, it's like buying a six-track right when the iPod is being introduced. It is a technology whose time is gone, and we now have better technologies, partly because a lot of renewables are now cost competitive. Both solar and wind in various parts of the world, including in that region, have started coming cost competitive. And therefore, I hope not just Pakistan, but many developing countries will leapfrog. If there is going to be an energy revolution in the world, I don't think it will come from mature economies in Europe and the US as much as emerging economies leapfrogging, you know, just skipping the dirty technology and leapfrogging to a cleaner technology, kind of like they did with cell phones.
Given the suffering of Pakistan from impossible floods to heat and drought, talk to us about the politics of climate change in Pakistan.
Unfortunately, there isn't much. Pakistan was mostly absent by its silence at Paris. But in my view, those who were speaking weren't making much sense either, but that's a separate issue. To the extent that there is climate change is an issue, unfortunately, Pakistan, like many other developing countries, has kind of wrapped itself in a shroud of victimhood. And it is not incorrect. It is correct. The victimhood is, we didn't create this problem. This is a problem that's been imposed on us by the excesses and the consumption of the developed world. Now, that happens to be true. But unfortunately, where I think it is wrong is that it leads to this thing, because we didn't cause it, we don't need to do anything about it. The reality of the science is that if you look at a world map of which countries and which areas are the most vulnerable, they are nearly all countries that have the least to do with creating the problem. So I can sulk in my victimhood, but that is not going to stop nature from throwing floods my way and heat my way and drought my way and glacial melt my way. And therefore, I think we are living now in what is the age of adaptation. And the front line of this, unfortunately, are the poorest countries, and within the poorest countries, the poorest communities. Now, that should again give a pause to you and me as, you know, the type of people who partly caused the mess. But it should also give us a moment to say, this is not simply about what we do with carbon. This is about how we do development. Because climate adaptation is a development issue. How do you deal with floods? not by controlling energy. How do you deal with heat? How do you deal with drought? How do you deal with any of these disasters? You deal through better development. And I think that's where the solution is. And we need to start coming back to the place that climate essentially is a development challenge.
You know, at the gates of Europe, when we look at the makeup of refugees, some are from Pakistan. And I'm wondering whether it's just too hard to grow things there, too hot to stand living there, too hard to live there sometimes.
It could be, and I think there is a very legitimate concern about environmental refugees. And we've seen that happening certainly in Africa and possibly in South Asia, including in Pakistan. But here is, I mean, I don't want to throw a totally gloomy picture. There is a lot of good, there is not good news. There is a lot of potential that is positive also. So, for example, I led a study with some colleagues in Pakistan where we looked at what climate change impact on agriculture would be. This is mostly an agricultural country. And found that over 25 years, we found that for the two major crops, it could be up to 15% of yield. Now, that's a major thing if your economy is dependent on it. But here is the interesting thing. What we found was that with good adaptation practices, development, the yield could actually go up 60%.
60%?
60.
Wow.
Right? And why is that? Because in Pakistan, as with many developing countries, there is a lot of room to grow into the better practices that they are not able to do because of lack of development, right? So either we treat climate change as a post-disaster reaction. We will wait for bad things to happen, and then we will, our humanity will arise, and we will send a little money so that we feel good about how we are helping the world. Or, as I've been arguing, we treat it as a development challenge, and before the bad things happen, we invest in development, and particularly what I was talking about, leapfrogging. So agriculture is one of those things. If you look at agriculture in developing countries, including Pakistan, there is a lot of room for good practices that would not only lessen the impact of climate change, but could actually allow countries to produce more. So I have always argued that the race here is between human knowledge and human wisdom. We have no dearth of knowledge on how to solve these problems. The challenge is that we have not demonstrated the wisdom or the will to deal with things that we are perfectly capable of dealing with.
Well, I think to do that, we'd have to escape something in our character that looks first at our own personal greed and very last at people on the other side of the world.
Exactly. And we have to realize that our, and this is where we may not yet be a fully evolved species. The assumption that what is good for me is only what happens in my immediate environment, you know, neighborhood, is just a patently false assumption. And that is why I get very concerned when anything first comes up, because it assumes immediately that everything else must be second. So to assume that someone on the other side of the world has no bearing on what happens to me, or should have no bearing, is not just morally wrong, it is intellectually bankrupt. And that we should have realized in realizing that the planet is interconnected. So just like Pakistan's floods or heat has to do with, may have as much to do with emissions, you know, half a world away, remember that what happens half a world away will impact us tomorrow. Maybe it impacts us, as you said, on those gates of Europe or tomorrow in the U.S., of people who leave their home and say, okay, if I can't live there, I'm coming where you are. But unless we start realizing that this is one planet, it's a fairly small planet, and we haven't done a good job with it, we are going to be in trouble.
What is the Pardee School of Global Studies?
The Pardee School of Global Studies is a school of international affairs. Boston University created the school 2 years ago by bringing together its various institutes and departments that work on international affairs. We have a global focus on global issues. and on international issues. So at one level, it is like any other school of international affairs. We study international relations, we study war, we study peace, we study economic development, terrorism. But we do have a particular focus on the global aspects and this realization that for the first time in human history, there are a whole bunch of processes that are not just international between countries, but global in how they operate. Environment and climate is obviously one of them, but international finance is another. International migration is another. So international information is another. And so the school is trying to build a school of international and global affairs that responds to the 21st century challenges that we are faced with.
So Pakistan is the sixth most populous country in the world. We should be watching it. If we want to be Pakistan watchers, what should we look for?
I think we should look for what is happening to ordinary people in Pakistan, like you are right now with the heat wave. Unfortunately, we look at too much. We should also look at that, but we look at it too much from the perspective of international security and terrorism. And this, again, is one of those areas where issues get connected. I do not think these are unrelated issues. If you have large populations of people who are uncomfortable, whose economic opportunities are limited, who are made even more limited by climate change, they are going to make decisions that will not be rational. So what we should be looking for is what happens to ordinary people. And this is not just for Pakistan. I think that is true everywhere. And I'll go back to what I said earlier. The tragedy is not that we have massive challenges. The tragedy is that we actually have the ability to solve them, and we keep abdicating that responsibility. Floods are one, but let me give you an easier example, food. There is no reason in the world for at least a quarter century now that anyone should die hungry anywhere. Right? Just from a mathematical sort of statistical point of view, there is enough food to feed everyone. And yet we know that people die hungry all across the world, even in the most affluent societies. That is not a failure of agriculture. That's not a failure of food. That is a failure of our institutions globally. And you can apply that principle to a whole number of things, including on Pakistan, but, you know, it's Pakistan today, it's Afghanistan tomorrow, it's going to be Africa day after tomorrow, but unless we develop the capacity to think of ourselves as citizens of the globe, we are going to be in trouble. That doesn't mean we become less of a citizen of a Pakistan or a U.S. or a Canada, but that does mean that we have to understand that we have the shared home and we have the ability to make it a better place.
You know, I'm concerned that we'll see continuous blows from climate disruption and it may lead to more failed states in different parts of the world. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about how it's going to go for Pakistan?
I suspect you are right, but for me, pessimism is not a choice. I don't know if I'm optimistic, but you have to keep trying. Right. If you become pessimistic and give up, then whatever little good that could happen will not happen. But I suspect that you are right, at least in part. I used to believe years ago, I spent too much of my life working on these issues years ago. I used to believe that maybe we will need some very great tragedy for the world to be shaken into action, that something really bad will happen and then we will act. Unfortunately, I and you have now lived to too many of those great tragedies, whether they are events like 9/11, whether they are floods like 2010, whether they are earthquakes in Nepal. We just keep getting tragedy after tragedy. And the unfortunate reality is that it has not shaken us up. In a way, it has routinized tragedies of a level that should not be routinized. You know, there's a rhythm to this. Something really bad happens. It gets plastered all over CNN. Twitter erupts in this great wave of empathy. And 2 days later, it's the next episode of the Kardashians or whatever, and we move on. And in some ways, our ability to show our empathy in 140 characters has made it easier for us to think, okay, my job is done. I wrote that tweet about how much I care about people dying this place or that. Now I can move on. And so part of me is a pessimist in that way. On the other hand, the possibility of our ability to do something keeps driving me to say we cannot give up.
Yes, a pessimist who won't give up. I think that's me as well. We've just heard from one of Pakistan's leading intellectuals. Dr. Adil Najam is an internationally recognized expert on international affairs. He's published widely and once hosted himself a public affairs program on Pakistan television. These days he's at Boston University as the dean of the Pardee School of Global Studies. You can find links to all of this in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Adil Najam, thank you. It's been a pleasure to have you on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.